I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Scott Harrison, founder of Charity Water, an organization that aims to provide clean water to communities in developing countries. There are over 500 million people without water globally. Scott launched Charity Water in 2006 after raising his first $15,000 from his friends at his 31st birthday party. Prior to launching Charity Water, Scott was a nightclub promoter. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Needless to say, one doesn't think nightclub promoter turns nonprofit founder.
It's not the traditional path.
And I'd like to dig into how that conversion happened, but I want to talk first about, you know, your life as a nightclub promoter. What led you to that profession after college at NYU initially?
Well, it was an utter act of rebellion, really. I had grown up in a very conservative Christian home. I was an only child. My mom was an invalid growing up, so she was really sick. And I was that good kid that played by the rules, that turned up in Sunday school, that, you know, did everything right until the age of 18. And I joined a band. I grew my hair down on my shoulders. I set off for New York City to make it rich and famous. And unfortunately for us, our band hated each other. So even though we were good, we couldn't stick together. So I learned quickly that the people on the other side of the business were the ones that made the money. They would, the promoters were the ones that would take the money and they'd throw $100 to us and say, you know, divvy that up seven ways. And then they would, you know, go home with pockets full of cash. So when the band broke up, I was 19 and decided to try my hand at the other side of the business. I mean, this was an extraordinary job. If you could get the right people inside nightclubs, you could charge them extraordinary amounts for liquor. I mean, people would pay $20 for a vodka soda. They'd pay $500 for a bottle of champagne that you could go buy for $30. And the next 10 years really flashed by as I was trying to climb up this social ladder to become, you know, one of the kings of New York nightlife.
Did it provide some catharsis for you to be able to kind of go out unfettered?
I think the business looks great from the outside. I mean, you're going to dinner at 10, you know, at the hottest restaurant in town. You're jumping into the back of town cars or limos with, you know, pretty girls. And you go to the club at 12. It starts to break down around 5 a.m. for a lot of people when the lights come on and then you go to some after hours. And you might crawl in bed at 10 or 11 a.m., and other people are on their lunch break. I remember looking out a window on Houston Street once at people in suits on their lunch break, and I hadn't been to bed yet. So there's a real, there's a dark underbelly, at least for me. It became incredibly destructive for me personally. Picture of my life at 28 years old. I had smoked two packs of Reds for 10 years. I had a drinking problem. I had a cocaine problem. I had a gambling problem. I had a pornography problem, strip club problem. Pretty much anything short of heroin, you know, I'd picked up as a vice over 10 years. And I'd come so far from the morality, the spirituality of, you know, my childhood.
At what point did you start to feel like, you know what, I am in an empty place?
I really had the moment of catharsis at 28 years old. I was in Punta del Este on this opulent vacation with the right people, the bottle buyers who had private planes, the people from Cirque du Soleil. And I remember we'd rented this insane house with servants and with horses, and there were magnums of Dom Perignon. And I remember going to the fireworks store and throwing down $1,000 for fireworks. And this was the life. My girlfriend at the time was on billboards and the cover of magazines, and I had a Labrador Retriever and a grand piano in my New York apartment and a BMW and all the things that should have made me fantastically happy. And I remember this party specifically at the house that lasted longer than I wanted it to. And a day and a half later, there were still drunk, you know, cracked out people, to be honest, that were partying on our compound. And I remember just wanting the music to stop. And I realized that I would never find happiness or, I don't even know what I was looking for at the time, but I wasn't going to find it in the next party. There would never be enough girls. There'd never be enough money. There would never be enough parties. And I saw my life play out. And if I continued down this path for another 10 or 20 years, if I were to be lucky enough to make it to 50, I would look like I was 100 years old, because it takes its toll. And, you know, what I saw around me was wreckage. You would see these guys whose wives had left them. They're dating, you know, girls often younger than their daughters. Their daughters didn't speak to them. And it was just kind of, it's like the veil was lifted. And I was able to see things a little more clearly as for what they were.
And at that point, you decided, you know what, I'm going to spend a year to have a catharsis from the last 10 years that I've spent. And you ended up on a ship. It's called the Mercy Ship, which is basically a floating hospital.
Yeah.
And this is after you were turned down by other organizations that wouldn't have you?
Well, on paper, I don't look like a great humanitarian at this point. So after this trip, I came back to New York, and I tried to find my way back to faith and spirituality and morality, but yet I was getting people wasted. I mean, that was my job. So being a pretty radical guy, I decided, okay, well, what would it look like to make my life look exactly the opposite? And I thought service to the poor. It's a long story, but I remember renting a cobalt blue Ford Mustang, and there was an unlimited rental, really, and I start driving aimlessly north. I wind up in Maine in a dial-up internet cafe on Moosehead Lake, and in this little location, I start applying to these famous humanitarian organizations, hoping that they would take me. Well, as you said, no one would take me. Very fortunately for me, one organization, the only one that hadn't rejected me, said if I was willing to go to Liberia, post-war Liberia at the time, and if I was willing to pay them $500 a month, I could volunteer. So there it was. I'd actually found the opposite of my life.
What did you find on the ship? And by the way, you know, to be on a ship for a year is pretty isolating.
It was. Well, I went from a pretty nice loft in Midtown at the time to a 200-square-foot cabin with two roommates that worked in the engine room and lots of cockroaches. And I remember feeling sorry for myself. I mean, look at these conditions, and I don't have privacy, I don't have space. And then I set foot outside into post-war Liberia. And I found a country with no electricity, no running water, no sewage, no mail. The healthcare system was completely debilitated. There was one doctor for every 50,000 people that lived in the country. You know, for comparison, I think we have a doctor for 180 of us here. And I remember on my third day in West Africa grabbing the camera, and it wasn't lost on me that I had a built-in audience of 15,000 people that I'd gotten drunk for a decade. So they went from getting invited to the Prada party to crazy pictures of leprosy and cleft lips and burns and massive benign tumors, really intense suffering. And my third day there, we turned up at a football stadium that the government had given us to screen our patients. And we had 1,500 surgery slots, which would book us for 8 months. And over 5,000 people were standing there. Thousands of people who had come with hope, many who had walked over a month with their children, hearing the doctors were in town, would be sent away simply because we didn't have enough resources. And that was one of the most devastating, life-changing moments for me.
You mentioned the 15,000 people watching you on, was it not really social media at the time?
It was just an email list.
And when did you first start to notice that a lot of these problems that you were seeing, leprosy, tumors, is that what it is, like tumors?
Yeah. We specialize in facial tumors.
Facial tumors were a result of poor water conditions.
Well, my job looked like this, and remember, this is the job that I was paying for to do, but I'd get up really early in the morning, I'd go down to the hospital ward, and I would meet the sick patients that would be operated on that day. I mean, some of these people had suffered for over a decade. Imagine something starts growing in your face, and there's no doctor or surgeon to go to, and it grows a little bigger and a little bigger and a little bigger, and 10 years later, you are choking for air. You can barely eat because you're suffocating to death on your own face. That's what we saw.
And by the way, these tumors are bigger than baseballs.
It's basketballs. I mean, some of them were 7 or 8 pounds. That was one part of the job, and these stories ended well. At the end of an 8-hour surgery, the basketball tumor has been thrown in the bin. The patient has been sewed up, and I got to watch them recover, and I got to take them home to their villages and watch them reaccepted by their family, you know, families who had written them off for dead, during huge celebrations and dancing and partying and welcoming them. So these were happy stories. But I started spending more time in the rural areas, going out deep into the bush, and I saw people drinking dirty water for the first time. Then I'm scrubbed up in these very elaborate surgeries, telling the surgeons what I'm seeing in the villages. And of course, the surgeons are saying, well, yeah, water is responsible for 53% of disease, for instance, in the developing world. And if people had their most basic health need met, Maybe there wouldn't be 5,000, 7,000 people turning up outside football stadiums. Mm-hmm. So that was the link.
Not to mention, I mean, we're talking about the quality water, but also the difficulty of obtaining water, how women walk for days to carry 30 pounds of water.
That's true. And I didn't see that at the time. Certainly now, in working in 24 countries, we've seen that. The stat around time wasted was 40 billion hours were wasted.
Can you break that down? Like, can you give an example or a story of what that looks like?
Sure. Well, I've seen a lot. A country that I love dearly and a place of a lot of impact for us is Ethiopia. So I've been there 27 times now. A couple of years ago, I really needed to reconnect with the mission. And I'd heard about this story that just didn't sound true. I'd heard about this 13-year-old girl that was walking 8 hours for dirty water, and one day she comes back in the village, and before she reaches her house, she's got this clay pot with all the water she's collected, and she slips and falls, and she doesn't make it home with the water. She breaks the clay pot. She spills the water, and as the story goes, she took a rope and she hung herself from a tree. So I didn't know if it was true, and I wanted to see if it was for myself, and if it was true, I wanted to live in that village for a week. So I hiked about 9 hours from where the road ended in the hot sun over the mountains. I had to bring my own water in so that I wouldn't get sick, and I found out this was a true story. Her name was Letikiros Haelu. I met her mom. I met the girlfriend that walked with her that day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I walked in her footsteps to this nasty water, this water you couldn't imagine ever drinking, water you wouldn't give your dog to drink, let alone your children. And I saw the clay pots that they used to carry, and they took me to the tree where they found her body, and they took me to her grave, and they told me about her funeral, and I met the Ethiopian priest that gave the service. And it was a really powerful experience, putting a name to that kind of suffering. And I remember asking before I left, I asked her friend who had walked with her that day, I said, why do you think she didn't just go back for water? Why end her life? And her friend said it would have been the shame that was too much for her because she had let down her family. Mm. They were counting on that water to cook dinner. Mm. Her mother, her brothers and sisters needed that water. And even worse, she had destroyed this clay pot because of her carelessness. Mm-hmm. And rather than face the family in the face of that shame, you know, she took her own life. These are not exaggerated stories. This is reality.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Scott Harrison, founder of Charity Water. We'll hear more from Scott coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Scott Harrison, founder of Charity Water, an organization that aims to provide clean water to communities in developing countries. There are over 500 million people without water globally. Scott launched Charity Water in 2006 after raising his first $15,000 from his friends at his 31st birthday party. Prior to launching Charity Water, Scott was a nightclub promoter. You decided to start Charity Water in 2006, and it struck me because I remember when I first heard about it, probably in 2006 or 7, I was like, Charity Water. Charity is such like a lame name. Mm-hmm. I wonder why he...
And also not very creative, right? Charity Water, like that's your name?
Right. Talk to me about that decision.
Yeah. So to paint a picture, coming back, so the 1 year with Mercy Ships actually turned into two, and... You know, I had been emailing my 15,000-person list, so it got a little smaller. There were a lot of people that unsubscribed from the tumors and the sickness and the dirty water. But I realized the power of telling these stories. I remember an email response, and it came from a woman that said, I'm sitting here at my desk at Chanel. Tears are streaming down my face. I never knew that a woman my age would go through this. How do I help? So I'd realized the power of these stories to move people towards compassion, towards empathy, towards generosity, both with their time and their money. So coming back, I am completely broke. I am living on a friend's closet. I mean, that is a closet floor.
Which friend?
It was an old club friend. My old club partner took me back in. And it wasn't a great time to start an organization with no donor base, with no... with no money. But I did have this credibility. I had 2 years where I had lived there and I had seen it. Mm-hmm. And I'd been telling these stories to the 15,000 people that I'd gotten drunk for so many years. Really, the charity for the first couple months was just called Charity. Mm-hmm. And it was even almost lamer than that. I was running around saying, hey, I want to start this charity called Charity. And for me, as I was talking to my friends, I realized they were disenchanted. 46% of Americans actually don't trust charity. But it meant love. You know, mm-hmm. Caritas in Latin. It simply meant to help those in need. And I had seen these incredible doctors for 2 years who could be on vacation with their families in the Maldives and instead are operating for free with their 2 or 3 weeks off, you know, giving everything they have. So I was not jaded by that experience. And I wanted to create an organization that would get people to take another look. And the colon was, you know, I wasn't sure what initiatives we would take on, but water seemed like the first place to start.
And one way you did that was by giving 100% of the money to the water projects.
From day one.
Right. So there was certainly, you know, that credibility, in addition to the technology component. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, the number one complaint most people have with charities is all around money. How much of my money will actually reach people? And I thought, well, what if we could create a different business model where you're not allowed to use that objection? So we reply 100% of your money. And then separately, we would figure out how to go and find a very small group of people and get them excited about overhead. We could do really cool things using technology to track those dollars. Whether a six-year-old gave $6 from her allowance or someone donated $100,000, we could show them which country, which projects that money actually helped fund.
So what does that mean? Like, did you walk into Staples and like buy a, like on the granular level, what did that look like at the very beginning?
We were very fortunate. We started the same year as Google Earth. And I kind of had this aha moment. Wow, Google has given us this free place where we could put every single water point we are ever going to fund up online, and we could make that publicly transparent. And it would be as simple as buying a $50 handheld GPS unit and training all of our local partners across our countries to turn on a GPS unit, take a picture of the GPS coordinates, take a picture of the project, and then we would make that data public. Mm-hmm. But at the simplest level, it was just, if we fund 100 water projects, you should be able to log on and see where those 100 projects are.
Some of your campaigns initially were very resonant with people. Can you talk about one or two that you remember?
Sure. Well, the brand was going to be really important to us. And as I looked at the charitable sector, I didn't see that Nike, the Apple, the Virgin. And I remember coming across this quote by Nick Kristof in the New York Times. And he said, toothpaste is peddled with far more sophistication than all of the world's life-saving causes. I thought, wow, that is true. And that is so busted. So a lot of interesting things. I mean, I remember early on we shot people, rich people in New York City in the same exact positions juxtaposed with people that we were trying to serve. Just posing the question, what if your mom had to get water from a swamp with bone and hair in it, it came down from, you know, a gully? What if your children had to walk to school every day with their school uniforms on with 40 pounds of contaminated water on their back?
And people working in finance coming up to Central Park Lake, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Central Park Pond. We took them up there. Imagine if you're, you know, lunch break in your Brioni suit, you've got to go get nasty water. One of our first PSAs actually was a fun story. We got Terry George, who had directed Hotel Rwanda, to donate his time, and Jennifer Connelly and her children. And we walked them up in a 30-second piece to Central Park. And Jennifer Connelly gets her kids this nasty water. And then she goes back in this beautiful Tribeca loft, and she gives her kid the only water that there is. Mm. And you see this putrid water and the kids looking at it. And it cuts at the end to say, imagine drinking this. Well, a billion people do.
You were fortunate in the early days to have support from Sean Parker and a Jack Dorsey and Daniel Ek, who's the founder of Spotify. Mm-hmm. How did the tech community become your friend? Was there one or two people that really was the turnkey for that?
Sure. There was one that really helped out. And I mentioned this 100% model, so I made that sound really great. Well, a year and a half in, the entire organization almost blew up. So I remember the overhead account was always low, and the water projects, we'd raise millions. So we come to this crossroads where we've got a few weeks left, and then we run out of money for payroll. But yet we had $883,000 on its way out to build water projects. And at that moment, I had written a tech entrepreneur out of the blue. I'd scraped his email off of the Who Is domain registry, mm-hmm. and I'd written a long, impassioned email completely about something else, not about money, about a product idea I had.
To Michael Burch?
To Michael Burch, yeah, for his social network, which was called Bebo at the time. I'd written him, I'd written Mark Zuckerberg, and I'd written Tom at MySpace. Mm-hmm. And Burch wrote me back, and he said, hey, I love the idea of this organization, but it's just really bad timing for me, and I can't help. So 6 months later, at this moment when we're about to run out of money and shut down the organization, he pops up and he says, hey, I'm coming through New York City. That email you sent a while ago was intriguing and I'd love to, you know, meet you.
Lucky you.
Lucky me. So he comes into the organization. We have a 2-hour meeting. I thought it went horribly. I thought he didn't like me. He's very British, so he was very reserved. And I remember just passionately kind of pouring out the vision for Charity Water, the purity, the 100% model, believing that this would get people to trust charity again if I could only get past the next few weeks.
And so he knew about your dire situation.
I remember being very transparent. And he left the meeting and said, well, let me think about it. And a couple days later, I remember it was well after midnight. I was working. I was praying with very little faith. I got an email from him saying, Scott, it was great meeting you. I've wired $1 million into the overhead account. And we went from running out of room to over a year in funding.
What in your past do you think gave you this instinct just to be as hardcore as you are, whether it's being a nightclub promoter or the absolute opposite?
Growing up, taking care of a sick mom was very difficult, but I was always needed. And my parents really said, look, you can do anything. I think there was just always this sense of possibility. I was enthusiastic. I loved telling stories. I remember having a police scanner and, you know, driving around a little town trying to find the story.
And your own story, of your mother's illness was very unconventional. What happened?
Yeah, when I was 4, we moved from Philadelphia to the suburbs of New Jersey to get closer to my dad's job. And he was just a middle-class businessman. And there was a carbon monoxide gas leak in this new home. So the gas company had installed a faulty furnace that had tiny cracks that leaked carbon monoxide. And my dad and I actually got a little sick at the time, but my mom was fixing up the basement, fixing up the house, was always in the house at the time, and slowly dying. And this is, you know, over 30 years ago, before the carbon monoxide detectors were prevalent. So I remember on New Year's Day, she walks across my parents' bedroom. She collapses unconscious on the floor. We rush her to the hospital, and it took a long series of tests to find these massive amounts of carboxyhemoglobin in her bloodstream. And so thankfully for our family, she didn't die, but her immune system was irreparably destroyed. And she went from this healthy, vibrant super mom, super wife, flying around the world, writing for the Philadelphia Inquirer, to a complete invalid, wearing charcoal masks connected to oxygen, living in a tile bathroom that had been washed with ivory soap that was completely covered in tinfoil, mm-hmm. sleeping on an army cot that was purified by baking soda. So she lived in the most extreme environment, and everything made her sick. So it was a bizarre childhood, for sure.
Is your mom still in that situation?
My mom got better when, interesting to the timing, when I went to the Mercy Ships experience, when I went to Liberia, West Africa, I came back and found her about 70% better. So part of it is just eating organic for 30 years and just figuring out how to avoid things that make her sick. When my wife and I and our son go and visit them, which we do about once a month, we still change into clothes that have been washed and purified. And she's able to function much more normally today.
I wonder if your change in what you were doing with your life gave her hope in a way that made her feel better.
I would like to say, you know, I wasn't responsible for her illness for all those years. Because I was a good kid growing up.
But yeah.
The timing was really interesting. I mean, my parents have this deep and authentic faith. At the time, they didn't sue the gas company for gross negligence. I think they took $20,000 as, hey, we're sorry, go away money. But my dad didn't want to become bitter.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Scott Harrison, founder of Charity Water, an organization that aims to provide clean water to communities in developing countries. You know, in addition to having support from the tech community, Google made a gift of $5 million to specifically help with remote sensors. Can you talk about the problem that you were seeing with some of your projects and how that helped?
We had raised $150 million from, you know, going on close to a million unique donors. So the organization had grown very, very quickly. A lot of things had worked. Timing was really helpful in the age of social media. We never direct mailed. You know, we're the first charity to get a million Twitter followers. We were the first charity morning one. I think it was us, NPR, and the Boston Celtics that got the first Instagram accounts. So we were just this culture of early adopters. We had all of these water projects out there. We knew where they all were. We had worked with a network of 24 local partners. So the important thing was we were not going to go send Westerners over to Africa or India or Asia and drill wells. We had gotten really good at identifying the best organizations in country to do that. And then we would raise the money to scale them up. So years later, that had worked. We've got maybe 15,000 projects out there. We know where they're all built. We put them all on Google Earth and Google Maps. But, you know, I began to wake up in the middle of the night and say, are they all working? We began sending teams of mechanics out to visit projects, specifically in Ethiopia, thousands of projects twice a year. So we got really nice results from that program, and I thought, well, what if there's a way to use technology to bring greater transparency to our work and inform better implementation and better sustainability? So that was the pitch to Google. We said, what if we could create a sensor from scratch? Nothing like this exists. It's got to be specifically for the AfriDev well, of which there are over a million just in Africa alone. It needs to work in extreme heat environments. It needs to be waterproof. We need to figure out how to transmit. We have to figure out how to power this thing. And it can't look like it's worth anything. So Google wound up giving us this $5 million grant, which at the time was the largest gift they had given a nonprofit. And we began to work with 20 different labs to try to create this sensor that would work for us. A lot of mistakes. It was a really challenging project. But currently, we have 1,000 of these sensors installed in Ethiopia. 700 are giving us daily data. So I can see how many liters of clean water are flowing from these villages.
What are some of the problems that you see on the field?
Well, working in 24 countries, lots of things can go wrong. We've had water quality issues. We'll drill wells sometimes and get massive amounts of fluoride and have to cap wells. You have possible arsenic issues. You'll have about 10% of the wells will be dry. If you're in a community and 1,000 people have gathered and they are waiting expectantly with their children, and 4 days later, you've got one or two dry holes and the rig moves to the next village. You know, these have some really devastating human impacts of deep sadness. It is not always easy. Charity Water has always taken a solution agnostic approach. So we fund 9 different technologies. There is no one size fits all to the global water crisis. Sometimes you can dig a well. Sometimes you can drill a well 1,000 feet. Sometimes you can build rainwater harvesting systems, spring boxes, gravity-fed systems, UV, carbon, UF.
Filters.
A lot of different things work. Some filters, biosand filters, high-tech filters. So typically, it is a simple solution. It is a well for a couple hundred people. It's typically not high-tech stuff that requires lots of maintenance or fuel. We've done solar projects. We really are willing to pilot a few new technologies. But across the portfolio, it's the simple stuff that really works.
You mentioned you mentioned your wife, Victoria, and your son. How did you meet Victoria?
Victoria was my second employee. So it was an office romance. On the second month of Charity Water, I got this idea to go out into New York City streets and show New Yorkers what it would be like if they had to drink from the East River, the Hudson River, and Central Park Pond. I think we raised about $20,000. Lots of New Yorkers came through. But Vic had volunteered at that exhibition. And I talked to her at the end of the day and said, what do you do? And she said, I'm a graphic designer. I said, oh, I need one of those. Brand, it's going to be really important. I don't have any money to hire you right now, but would you consider volunteering? So she was working at an ad agency, and she starts moonlighting, helping us create the logo, build the brand. Us, I mean, there was me and one other person living on floors, working around a couch. There was no money in the beginning. I mean, it was all volunteer. Maybe a couple months later, raise a little bit of money for a donor to maybe pay 3 months of her salary. And she winds up leaving the agency, taking a pay cut, giving up all of her health benefits, and then says, well, I need to go to Africa and actually see one of these projects for myself to design with authenticity. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, we have no money to send you there, so you're on your own. Mm-hmm. So she winds up putting the ticket on her credit card, going to Liberia, where things had started for me. Coming back, she comes back with malaria. She gets checked into Beth Israel, and she comes out with a $39,000 bill.
Oh, my.
This is more than her take-home pay for an entire year. And I remember just saying, oh, no, we're going to have to go on a very long payment plan. You know, my wife has my wife now has a childlike faith in a way, and she's like, all right, I'm going to pray that God makes this entire thing go away and there's some crazy miracle. So wouldn't you know it, she calls up her old employer, and she gets the head of HR on the phone. And the head of HR says, hey, aren't you the girl that left to go work on that humanitarian thing, like helping people get water? She says, let me plug you in the system. So she plugs Vicky in the system and finds out that she is still technically employed there. They never cut off her health insurance. And she said, I'm going to pay this entire bill today, and I'm going to disconnect you tomorrow. And the entire thing went. Long story short, over the next year, you know, working together around a couch, 80, 90-hour weeks, my best friend said to me, I was oblivious. I was just trying to build the organization. I wasn't dating, tunnel vision. My friend says, hey, you have this beautiful girl. She loves God. She loves to serve the poor. Like, what is wrong with you? You know, ask her out. So I have this awkward moment. And again, there's a few of us at this time. And I walk into the office and say, hey, have you ever thought about us? And she says, yes! She actually just left Charity Water after 9 years as mm-hmm. creative director. I made her a co-founder at a very tearful ceremony a few weeks ago. And mm-hmm. she has been instrumental. I miss her already at work.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Scott Harrison, founder of Charity Water, or I should say co-founder of Charity Water, since his wife is the other co-founder, Victoria. Coming up, we'll meet Berta Gonzalez-Nieves, co-founder of Casa Dragones. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Berta Gonzalez-Nieves, co-founder of the tequila brand Casa Dragones. Casa Dragones is a joint venture between Berta and Bob Pittman, the founder of MTV. Madonna, Martha Stewart, Oprah, and Le Bernardin chef Eric Ripert are among Casa Dragones' celebrity fans. The first batch of Casa Dragones, about 12,000 bottles, was launched in 2009. Berta grew up in Mexico City. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica. I'm excited to be here.
I want to talk first about tequila in general. Could you describe exactly what your tequila consists of?
Of course. There's five official classifications of tequila in our appellation of origin. Blanco, joven, reposado, añejo, and extrañejo, and I can say that in English. White, young, rested, aged, and extra aged. For our joven in particular, when we founded Casa Dragones, we set on a quest to produce a true sipping tequila. And we found that the joven style was the style that wasn't going to enable us to truly deliver a spirit that invited you to sip and to savor, and that actually paired well with food.
Tequila comes from the agave plant. Mm-hmm. I think of, you know, agave syrup as like a sugar substitute. But can you describe the agave plant and how you make use of it?
Most people think that agave is a cactus. It's not a cactus. It actually belongs to the succulent family, and it's actually closely related to the lily. It's really a very noble plant. In Latin, it means admirable and noble. And the plant is a plant that takes 8 to 12 years in average to be ready to be harvested. And what you're looking for in the plant is you're looking to keep, to harvest your plants when they have the most concentration of sugar reductors in the heart of the plants.
And then you ferment that and or you take the sap from that heart?
That's correct.
You said it takes, you know, 8 to 10 years for the plant to grow. And that's why it's my understanding a lot of tequilas have other sugars in it, because the harvesters don't want to wait 8 to 10 years. And yet your tequila has only the agave sugar.
Yeah. I mean, we only produce 100%. Agave. We are going on the route of producing very small batches that have very strict attention to detail to be able to stand on the shelf with categories that have been in the luxury segment for a very long time.
Incidentally, the flowers of the agave plant are pollinated by a bat. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that?
The plant is pretty incredible. It has a diversity of ways of reproduction. The plant actually clones itself from its root and grows hijuelos that then grow around the plant, and you wait on average 1 or 2 years to actually take the hijuelo and then plant it in a new field. That is the most traditional way of, in our category, of actually reproducing the plant. If you let the plant grow its stem, which is a 15 to 20 feet long stem that grows a very beautiful white flower at the end, that is a plant that's pollinated by bats.
Do you have an agave plant in your apartment?
I don't have an agave. I've tried it, but the plant really is looking for the right temperature. One of the most important factors is a nighttime climate because it's a MAC-type plant that does its photosynthesis at nighttime.
So it's probably not a coincidence that this nocturnal plant is pollinated by a nocturnal animal.
That's correct.
I want to switch to your bottling. Can you describe, for those who don't see it, what the bottles look like and how they're made?
When we founded the company, we wanted to really sell Mexican craftsmanship. We tried to get inspiration from all over Mexico and found an exhibit in the Museo de Arte Popular in Mexico City. And they had an exhibit specifically of the history of glass in Mexico. We found a very beautiful, a lot of work in apothecary bottles, and a lot of work in the traditional hand engraving method of pepita.
Pepita meaning small seeds.
Yes. We took that idea and worked with a local Mexican bottle producer to produce a antique decanter, but made modern. Mm-hmm. And all of this is done by hand.
In addition to the glass itself, which has this pepita engraving, it's also, each bottle is hand-signed. Can you describe that?
Because we're a small batch producer, we number every bottle by hand, and obviously with a date of when we bottled it and produced this specific batch. And every bottle is hand-signed by, we're two maestro tequileros, is Benjamin Garcia and Berta Gonzalez. Benjamin was the first person that I convinced to be part of the team. And when we did our first batch, we realized that we both had the same initials. Mm. His name is Benjamin Garcia and mine Berta Gonzalez, so we didn't have to fight over who is signing the bottles. Mm. So depending on who's in our production facility, either one of us is signing the bottles.
The brand is only since 2009, but the name itself, Casa Dragones, has a deep history. Dragones refers to the Queen's Cavalry, which lived in the town of San Miguel de Allende, which is kind of the cultural heart of the company. Can you explain the history of Dragones in Mexico?
The Dragones were living in San Miguel de Allende, and San Miguel de Allende is one of the most elegant colonial towns in the heart of Mexico. The Dragones were already four generations of Spaniards living in the New Spain, and they were a little bit tired of all the changes in the Bourbonic crown, as well as all the taxes that they had to pay for the crown. So they masterminded the movement of Mexican independence from San Miguel de Allende. The first conspirational meeting happened there in San Miguel. And because we're doing something, we're trying to be rebels in our own category, we got really inspired by the rebellious spirit and spirit of independence. And my business partner, Bob Pittman, has a house in San Miguel de Allende that actually was the stables of the Dragoons.
And as a nod to that independent ethos, you have the number 16 on your logo, which was the date of independence, September 16th, 1810.
Yes. And as well, as a coincidence, that's the actual address of the house, is Recreo 16. And the color of our box is actually the color of their flag. And it has these tones of blue, that's where we got the inspiration.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Berta Gonzalez Nieves, co-founder of the tequila company Casa Dragones. Casa Dragones is known for its small-batched Joven tequila, which uses 100% blue agave grown in the region of Tequila, Jalisco, Mexico. Berta grew up in Mexico City. You were first introduced to tequila by your grandmother, your maternal grandmother. Can you tell us about that?
So my grandmother and my grandfather had an open house every Monday. So we all had lunch there. Lunches in Mexico are very no one misses lunches. So every Monday, everybody had their glass of tequila. So growing up, I was like, when is going to be my turn? When is going to be my turn? And I bogged until one day my grandma said, okay, that's it. It's such a family occasion, you know, to drink tequila as an aperitif before a family meal that is so ingrained in our culture. It's really part of the fabric of the Mexican culture. We like to drink tequila for a wide diversity of reasons.
Speaking of family, your family is one of entrepreneurs. Your father and his family ran a cosmetic company, which also was focused on flavors and fragrance, right?
Yes. That was very exciting growing up to have the exposure to my grandfather and my father and my uncle that were entrepreneurs in the cosmetics industry. And they had company that competed in direct sales with Avon and in retail with Maybelline and Max Factor. And I worked every summer there, and I had the chance to discuss with my father every type of like packaging and every type of aroma and if a shampoo worked or if a cream was better. And then he sold it when I was in my, before I turned 20. So I was very upset because I thought that I could do a career there, but I will forever be thankful that I was able to find my own passion.
So how did you stumble into the business of tequila?
I stumbled into the business of tequila. I was selected by the Japanese government to represent Mexico in a program in Japan. And as part of my training, I got invited to visit some of the top Mexican industries to be able to speak about them eloquently. And one was a tequila category. So I spent a couple of days in Tequila, Jalisco. And after the second day, I called my parents and I said, I know what I want to do. I want to go into the tequila industry. And they were like, okay, you know, early 20s, maybe flavor of the month, we'll see. And it was not the flavor of the month.
Well, thank you, Japan.
Thank you, Japan.
Yeah. So you eventually got to the United States. You got an MBA from Northwestern Business School. And after business school, you worked for Grupo Cuervo, which makes Jose Cuervo tequilas. And you were with them for a decade or so, where you basically learned the ropes of tequila. And when you said, okay, I want to start a tequila company, how did you find Bob Pittman, or how did he find you to go into this together? How did you meet?
We met in a party in Williamsburg.
Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, with common friends that were celebrating their 10th year anniversary. Here I am in a terrace in Brooklyn, and I'm talking to the founder of MTV. He's like, well, what do you do? And I'm like, well, I'm in the tequila industry. What do you do? Oh, let me tell you, I have all these ideas. I've always wanted to produce a tequila. Let's sit down and talk. And you know, in New York, you never know. Mm-hmm. So 2 weeks later, we were in his office talking about tequila. And his passion, determination, entrepreneurial nature, and understanding of the Mexican culture really took me by surprise.
So he had at the time his house in San Miguel de Allende?
He was already spending all of his summers in San Miguel de Allende.
Okay, so he had street cred.
Enamored by the Mexican culture and really, really serious about tequila.
Sure. What are the chances?
Yeah, what are the chances? From there, the conversations got more formal, and then we decided to really do this business together. So I worked on a business plan and presented it to him and to his private equity firm, and that's how we got started. And literally, they lent me an office space in Bob's office, and I came in at the time with my BlackBerry and my notebook, and they gave me a phone, and we started from scratch.
So do you feel that Bob's interest helped to escalate your seriousness about the pursuit?
I mean, definitely that gave me another set of an engine that said, like, this could be happening. And we had the deal that if we were not going to be able to innovate and truly expand the repertoire, we were going to abandon the project.
You know, in addition to Pittman, later investors include Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Frederick Fakai, Tom Freston, the former CEO of Viacom, and Ryan Seacrest. For me, the most intriguing part of this list is Jeff Bezos of Amazon. What was surprising to you about, like, this roster of investors?
Everything about it was surprising to me. Having the opportunity as an entrepreneur to have access to these incredible executives and brilliant minds to help me craft.
So has Jeff helped you in any way, or has any of these people kind of given you
all
pieces?
Of them have helped me.
What are examples?
All of them have helped me. I mean, Tom Freston, in one of the meetings that we had, he decided to give a bottle to Oprah Winfrey for her birthday, and that opened a whole new door. I can tell you, I mean, obviously starting with Bob. Bob, from like the way to balance a balance sheet to like how do you look at a business, how do you start a business, where do you spend, where you don't spend, how do you build excitement with your team, having the chance to actually pitch or share our business with Jeff Bezos, and having to open all of our information for him to become an investor also makes us a much stronger and viable venture.
So you've certainly had a lot of support by just the celebrity community in terms of being fans and also your investor base. What has been harder for you than you thought?
There were some times where you, like, when you start and you start with 12,000 bottles and you're selling bottle per bottle to one each restaurant and one each retailer, and I'm talking about Mexico and the U.S.
Right.
I mean, and you are with your own, like, tennis shoes on the street doing this, you really don't know where that's going to go, mm-hmm. you know, and especially we started producing the best product we could deliver during 2009. In the middle of the recession.
For $275 a bottle.
Yeah. So some people were looking at us like, do you really know what you're doing? Learning to live in that realm, learning to live in that area as an entrepreneur, I think at the beginning that's a tough calibration.
Who were one of your earliest supporters? Which restaurants?
Yeah, one of our earliest supporters was Le Bernardin, Eric Repair. You know, and we continue to be very, very proud of being one of the products that they pour there. I had the chance to meet him in a school event, in a benefit in the Hamptons, where we were serving Casa Dragones, and I was going table per table serving the product, and I was able to have a conversation with him. Hmm. And then he actually then paired it with chocolate truffles. So the whole exploration of actually pairing with food started with him here and with Enrique Olvera in Mexico City. Another one that we are very proud of is La Cava del Tequila in Epcot in mm-hmm. Florida. We have Thomas Keller with Per Se. Soho House was one of our early adopters.
Just going back to kind of like the early days of actually, you know, being out in the field and harvesting the agave, you brought in this maestro tequilero. His name is Benjamin Garcia, and you mentioned him before because he signs his name on the bottle just as you do, the same initials. And yet he was retired, but you brought him out of retirement. Can you tell us about that?
So we're going to do this. The first person that I called was Benjamin. We had worked in a lot of projects together. We were actually marathon buddies. We were in different projects together, developing new products and so on. So I called him and said, Benjamin, I have to come and see you. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, come over. So I came over and I said, I'm not leaving your house until you say yes. Mm-hmm. So in this project, we're going to have the chance to do everything we've dreamt of doing. Mm-hmm. And if you're really going to retire, you need to retire with the best home run that you can do.
You're this expert in tequila. I am not. So how do you teach a gringo like myself to drink good tequila? Because it has this reputation of just drinking it like lighter fluid, and that's it. How would you introduce one to the experience?
I think it's really taking the time to sip and savor a product. So every time if you're in a restaurant and you ask for a tequila, take three minutes to ask your waiter or your bartender to say, where does this come from? How is it produced? And start really trying to see that category to where it's at today. It starts with, like, just giving yourself 3 seconds of trying to savor what you're trying rather than being on a hurry. In our particular case, when we do a tasting, we take probably half an hour before you taste the product, just telling you how we do it and trying to take you through the aroma and through the visual characteristics of the product. Like wine, definitely.
Connected to aroma, what kind of perfume do you wear? So much of your work is the nose. What do you wear?
I like very Mediterranean aromas. So I am wearing today, I'm wearing Neroli Portofino of Tom Ford. And I also like the green perfume or cologne of Hermes. So I like very light, very simple aromas that are very fresh. I don't like very sweet perfumes. Actually, and when you are in production or when you are in a tasting, you can't wear any type of perfume or cream or anything. The kit that you use to train to be able to, for Maestro Tequileros, mm-hmm. is a kit that has all these different aromas, and you're training your nose to be able to discover them in a product.
Yeah.
So that then when you can sit in a table and we all have the same vocabulary. So that exercise is very similar than in a perfume.
Are you ever out there in the fields kind of harvesting the heart of the tequila?
Yeah, I mean, that's the most favorite part of this business, mm-hmm. is the production process. Do I Do I spend most of my time in the fields? I don't. But that definitely is an area that I cherish and enjoy every time I'm doing it.
Just the solitude of it, just like quiet. And you said you harvest in the morning or before the sun is beating.
Yeah.
Can you just provide a visual?
It's 5 a.m. in the morning. The sun is coming out. You have a very fresh, almost cold temperature. The noise of the fields and the work of the jimadores that early in the morning, and the smell when you're cutting and when you're harvesting, is really an inspiration for everything else that we do. There is no machine that is involved. It's all physical labor. And the people that work the fields are generations of people that have been taking care of agaves for many, many, 11 generations. It's the most romantic part of our process.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Berta Gonzalez-Nieves, co-founder of Casa Dragones.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.